Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Melissa, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in their own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. This gives a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, later listening on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing.
I'm Bill D. I'm an alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here tonight to introduce Amanda T. as our speaker. She's truly an extraordinary woman. She's been sober a couple of years. But if you look at her big book is so well-thumbed that it looks like a 30-year-old big book. And that's because she really works this program. And she really works the steps. And her experience is something that I have found invaluable. And I'm delighted to have Amanda.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Melissa, Tim, Bill. I'm Amanda, and I'm an alcoholic. Just a couple weeks ago, a friend was up here who has 45 years sober. In the last couple weeks, the speakers have been amazing. My sobriety date is July 17th, 2022, so I have about 2 years and change. So I don't know who let me up here to share tonight, but I am grateful for the opportunity. One thing I was thinking about is how much power my story has had over me historically. Anyone finding out about it, anybody finding out about what was going on with me, was like worst case scenario. So the ability to share honestly, the more that I talk about it, the more that I'm able to like get out what has happened and what's going on the inside, the more it builds understanding and awareness, for my recovery. And so doing stuff like this helps me work out not only what has happened, but what's going on in real time. So I really appreciate you all being here to listen. It's helpful. I would say a little over 2 years ago, I was on my way back to treatment. This was my seventh detox intake, and it was on my way to my eighth treatment intake. I was living in Nashville at the time and absolutely crashing and burning. And my mom and my aunt packed me up in the car again. And I vomited all the way to Dalton, Georgia, in a plastic bag in the back of my mom's seat's car, the back of my mom's car in a plastic bag. And then I got out and was in a McDonald's parking lot, and I vomited in the McDonald's parking lot. And, like, couldn't keep anything down, but I was so hungover and so sick and so depleted that, like, I couldn't drink anything, I couldn't not drink anything, and then I got in the back of a random Lyft vehicle and proceeded to vomit in the back of that woman's vehicle all the way to Black Bear Lodge in Georgia. So now I'm here, and it's a couple of years later, and at that time I would not have been able to foresee doing this evening, because I just didn't think I'd be able to stay sober. I hadn't been my experience to date, the ability to stay sober. And so how did I get to that point? Back it up a little bit to provide some context, trying to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm the youngest of three girls. So I grew up with my parents and two sisters. We grew up in a Church of Christ household. So for those that don't know, it's very conservative. So, like, my upbringing really revolved around going to church, and we would go Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday evening, plus. And the church that my parents found, I grew up in southern Ohio. It was like over 35 minutes away, one way. So we would pass by this sign that said, like, a church alive is worth the drive. And that was like our family motto. And so I grew up doing that, playing tennis, going to school. I liked school, so I was kind of one of those that was just like, do all the things you're supposed to do. But this like church upbringing, it was very intense and pretty conservative, and so it was kind of like, just make sure you don't do anything wrong. And then if you don't do anything wrong, you're fine. But if you do, like, good luck to you. And so the plan was just to never do anything wrong and to never show any weakness, don't need anything, don't rock the boat. If something was wrong, are you already fixing it? Do you already know what you did? Do you already know what you need to do? Okay, great. And so that set up the dynamic that if I seemed okay, I was okay. And if you approved of me, I approved of me. And if you were proud of me, then I was worth being proud of. And so it was kind of this way of being where, like, what the outside looked like was much more important than what was happening on the inside. And that's kind of, like, how I learned to operate. And that worked pretty well as far as I knew because I didn't know anything different. And so I played a lot of tennis growing up. So I did well in school. I was in junior tennis, top of the juniors. I won a couple high school championships. Went to a D1 college, played for D1 college, top 10. And by the end of college, I was in a place where I had a chance to play pro tennis. So I played some professional tennis as well after that. I actually hated playing pro tennis, but it was like the idea that was so good that I wanted to like make it work. And so that was just another way that it was like, what's happening and what it sounds like my life looks like is much more important than what's actually happening. Through middle school, definitely solidified in high school. I was constantly like achieving things, but internally I was perpetually scared, unsatisfied, very self-conscious. I have generalized anxiety and depression, but I wasn't able to access or understand that that was a part of who I am, are things that I may have to deal with because I was like steamrolling my way through life. So as long as I was like going through, accomplishing, doing things, then like I wasn't slowing down enough to like get in touch with that internal side of myself. My first drink was in high school, like with some older people, and I thought it was pretty cool. It was very, like I remember having a great experience with it. It wasn't anything like, I didn't get drunk the first time I drank or anything like that. It was just like, I feel so relaxed and I feel so cool. And it was easier to interact with people, but like, it was still like, drinking was still sort of like not allowed. And so I didn't want to veer too far outside the lines, but I did enjoy it quite a bit. And when I did drink in high school, it was Boone's Farm, for anybody that may remember that. And that was like just so delightful to me. And so I didn't really have like negative experiences with alcohol pretty early on. But I did, I went to a D1 college, and it was there. My two older sisters went to smaller Christian colleges, and I went to this school that was just like work hard, party hard. And I learned that, and I did work hard, but I also started to party hard, and I didn't really know how to, like, integrate. I was still, like, trying to be president of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and do that authentically with also knowing, like, I really liked to go out on the weekends, and I liked being able to drink as much as I wanted to, and I didn't really know how to, like, weave the extreme conservatism and like this judgmental tone that I had grown up with like this bigger life that I was starting to experience where there was just the way of being that was making sense to me in the world didn't sort of square with the upbringing that I had. And so I was constantly trying to be like respectful of my upbringing and respectful of this like religious intense make sure that you do the right thing with like life is big, and we, you know, learning about other people and other things. And I didn't even know that I was a fundamentalist Christian until I got to college. And then I was taking, like, this religion course, and they were like, Church of Christ, it's fundamentalist. And I was like, I don't know what that is or that I was that. So there was kind of, like, a lot of learning along the way of what was going on. But I bring that up just because I started to sort of deconstruct my faith, and it was kind of like, I don't know that I'm really loving everything about my upbringing and about what this means for my life, and I also wasn't accessing it in a very real way where it was making a difference in my life. So it was kind of more about, like, don't do anything wrong, stay within the lines, than it was about, like, really having a spiritual existence or way of being. I also hated my body. I was, like, starting again in middle school, I was, like, the friend of pretty people, but not one of the pretty people. I was bigger than everyone else. I felt like I was taking up too much space. And I didn't really know what to do with that because I was athletic. And, I was a tennis player, and all this stuff was happening with that. But it was like my body was wrong. And I got bullied a little bit for that. But it was like when I heard the bullying, the way I internalized it was kind of like, you're just saying something that's true, and I'm the one that's in the body, and I'm the one that's wrong. So, like, it was my fault that was happening. And so, like, other people could tell me that I was okay or tell me that I was pretty, but I was like, you're just saying that, and I know the truth, and you can't fool me. And so I developed this really, like, tumultuous relationship with food and with my body, and just my body is, like, separate from who I am, and despising it. And that helped me treat it as crappy as I needed to and as crappy as it deserved. And I also bring that up because that plays a part into how I behave as an alcoholic. Like, whatever I do to this thing, who cares? We don't like it anyway. So I spent my 20s in grad school, work, trying to be an adult, just trying to move fast enough to ignore any problematic feelings. Alcohol was definitely a part of my life, but it wasn't central to my life. So it was becoming more and more important in my social interactions, and, you know, I'd, like, go out and whatever, but I had a lot of friends from my church environment, and I had friends from school environment, and, like, I don't know. So it just, it didn't feel like it was a huge part of my life. I got married in 2014. I was very nervous that I was going to mess it up because I just, like, had this underlying feeling, like, something's wrong with me. I'm going to find a way to mess this up. But I was managing so well at the only way I knew how to manage life that I just kept going. And it was like, I don't know. This, like, the train was moving so fast. It was like, I can't do anything to slow this train down. And so I'm just going to stay on it. I had plenty of embarrassing moments, but nothing that would cause me to change my behavior. Like, I was a bridesmaid in a wedding on New Year's Eve, and I drank so much during the day that I passed out on a toilet before midnight even hit, and I missed, like, some important pictures, and I had to get, like, carted home. My now ex-husband, but my husband's 30th birthday, we had people over, and then we went out after that. Somebody else found me passed out on the toilet. There's a lot of toilets in my story. And, like, I would just drink, you know, a ton, but I wouldn't want anyone else to know how much I was drinking, and so then it would just be like, surprise, we found her on a toilet, you know? Like, waking up over and over again, not remembering exactly what had happened or what I had said, and kind of wondering, like, how embarrassing was it? How much can I get away with? How much should I pretend, or how much should I acknowledge that I drank? Not knowing. And you can always, like, I could always rationalize an incident, like the wedding. Oh, I've got, you know, this is exactly what happened, I shouldn't have done this, and if I would have just done it differently, it would have been fine. So once I got married, I moved from Nashville to Louisville to start my PhD, and I got married, changed up location, schedule, job, life, and that left a lot of unstructured time, which I did not know what to do with or how to handle. the start of my program, I was just like thinking I was having a classy glass of wine while I would write. And then by the end of my program, I was really lonely, and I was finding ways to sneak alcohol, and my husband had quit drinking because he just, it didn't make him feel good, so imagine that, he just stopped. And so I would want to drink, but I would have a glass of wine at night, but then, like, I didn't want to drink as much as I wanted to drink in front of him, so, like, I would do things like wait for him to get in the shower, and then he was in the shower and chug, 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 chug. And then it would look like I had only had a glass of wine. So I just, it started up this dynamic of like, I'm not going to tell him how much I'm drinking because I know he'll judge me for it, and I can't be operating on a regular basis getting judged. But after I finished up at Louisville, we moved to Alaska on our way back to Nashville. And it was in Alaska where I was trying to finish up my dissertation. I did not know anyone. I did not have anyone out there. And I was staying in, like, one-bedroom hotel rooms or studio apartments and just, like, so miserable. Like, I – depression and anxiety definitely caught up with me. And I could not, like, figure out how to move forward. And I started drinking and, like – he would go off to work for 12 or 14 hours at a time, and I would try to be productive, but I didn't know how to be productive, and so I would just find ways to sneak alcohol and then just watch TV for like 10 or 12 hours in a row. And it was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing with life. This is all that I know how to do. And like the thing that I like about drinking is that when I would, and I started drinking like hard liquor because I was fastest. And when you drink, like, it goes in and it's warm, and I can, like, feel it go down my throat. I can feel it in my stomach, and it, like, it goes from this, like, a lot of chaos in my brain to, like, all that I can think about is just, like, okay, it's in there. I feel settled. I feel calm. And so now, like, in recovery, I can recognize I'm able to clear my head. I'm able to do that without alcohol, but at the time, I didn't have anything else. So, like, things were feeling more and more chaotic and more, like, depressing. I was depressed. And I didn't know what to do with it. And alcohol, like, if I can focus on getting the next drink and having the next drink and how to, like, keep from getting found out, I don't have to think about anything else. Like, I don't have to worry about all of these other things that I don't know how to deal with. And so I thought that when we moved back to Nashville, that would maybe fix it. I thought when I got a full-time job, that would maybe fix it. But I didn't get a full-time job for a while. And I already had all of these, like, very sneaky drinking habits in place. And so I was doing part-time work and stuff like that, a lot of tutoring. But then, like, at this point, I was, like, alcohol had, like, very nefarious. It was, like, very sneaky, intimate relationship with alcohol that kind of snuck up on me. And then there were certain moments where I would be like, I deserve it. Like, I'm tutoring this kid. This kid's a jerk. And, like, he's so hard to be around, and I got to be around him all the time. Like, I would chug a beer before I go in. And it would be like, I'm not drunk, so I'm not doing him a disservice. Like, this kid doesn't know. But then I did get a full-time job. And that ended up being an hour and a half away. So I was driving an hour and a half to work because that's where our main campus was. And then an hour and a half back, and, like, I have a job, I have my PhD, like, things should be fine. And, like, things were so far from fine, but I, again, the train was barreling forward, and I didn't know how to stop it. Like, there was no part of me that knew or would try to stop it. So my job was also more unstructured and confusing than I was prepared for, and I also was very accustomed to not asking for help. So, like, I felt very unsupported, but it's also amazing how unsupported I can feel when I don't ask for help and when I don't tell anybody that I'm struggling. So I'm doing this hour and a half commute every day, 3-hour commute every day, and, like, very unsurprisingly, when I started drinking and driving during that commute, things did not turn out well. I got a DUI in 2019, and I So I wasn't even driving when I got my first DUI. I had parked in a strip mall parking lot, and I was going to go in and get food and sober up before I went home because I was avoiding home. And I woke up to, like, this bang on my car door window from a police officer, and I was woken up. Like, people thought, this girl's on drugs. We don't know what's going on. Like, we don't know what's wrong with her, but she won't wake up. And so I did a field sobriety test, which I definitely failed. I was in my work outfit, so I'm, like, getting arrested in heels. I'm trying to do a field sobriety test in heels. And so then all of a sudden it's, like, handcuffs, cop car, jail. And I, like, this was the first, like, real bad thing that I had ever done and that had happened in my family. And so it was so surreal. It was just like, this is not reality. Like, this is not my world right now. And then on my way to work the next morning, I stopped at the liquor store. Because it was like, this is too much. And I didn't know how to deal with anything without alcohol. And so, like, alcohol had snuck in as, like, my trusty sidekick. And it was, like, this secret that was just mine. And when I could focus on that, again, I didn't have to be focusing on all of this other stuff and, like, the reality of my life. My family convinced me to go to rehab after that, and I felt like my world was ending. I was only there for 2 weeks, but it felt like the longest 2 weeks of my life, and it felt like you're an alcoholic now, and this is exactly what you need to do. We want you to do ABC, and if you do ABC and you don't question it and you don't deviate, then you're going to have this sobriety that we want for you. It was like, I don't want sobriety. Like, I don't want that yet. But I did want to follow the rules, and I did want to please everybody. I wanted to be a good wife. I wanted to be a good daughter. I wanted to be a good aunt. I wanted to be a good sister. I wanted you to be able to rely on me, but I couldn't really rely on me. I was feeling, like, so out of control. I was so miserable and so confused that I couldn't make it through a day without wanting to, like, crawl out of my skin. And I also, now this was a taste of, like, living outside of the lines. And I had always lived inside the lines, and I felt like everybody in my, especially my immediate family, was like, we live inside the lines. But now I was like, well, she's been to jail, so we don't know what's going on with her. And it felt like no one could understand me or grasp what I was going through or what I needed. And I was, like, very alone. But alone was also where I was safest. If you couldn't understand me and you didn't know what I was going through, then any advice that you had for me was kind of irrelevant. Like, you don't know how hard I'm trying. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what's happening here. So if you're trying to give me advice and you're trying to direct what happens in my life, I can avoid you. I can reject that. I can deny it. I can delay it. I did a lot of delay until I couldn't anymore. But I was really freaking everybody out around me. Like, I was driving drunk all the time, you know, even after the DUI. And so they did things like put a breathalyzer in my car before it was even required by the state. Yeah. And my parents flew in 1 week. My dad drove me to work every single day, made that 3-hour commute every single day. Like, the amount of control that they wanted to exert over somebody who was out of control, it only made me want to control my drinking even more. And so there was just, honestly, I feel like my husband was trying really hard. I feel like he really tried. Like, he wanted to be there. He wanted to be a good partner, and he wanted to figure out how to do it with me. But, like, the message that I was hearing was, if you would just fix yourself, we would be fine. And I couldn't fix myself. And I was also like, and also, why don't you think about some of the things that you're doing over here? Because I'm trying to fix myself. What are you trying to do? And it just felt like, but I would sneak alcohol into the house, and I just, like, the thing, when you have a breathalyzer in your car, you can still drink, but you have to drink an exact calculated amount so that you don't blow into it the next morning. And so, like, I did that, and, like, I would wake myself up at, like, 3 in the morning and just drink a whole bunch of water. Because I, you know, and, like, I was miserable. It was a prison of my mind and my body. And I would do it over and over and over and over and over again. And I was so miserable, but I just, like, couldn't, there was no other way of existing that I knew. And I was, like, disconnecting from reality. But the conversations and the people that were close to me, they were trying to, like, bring me closer to reality, and reality was, like, horrible. It was very raw. It was very scary. It was, reality was where people were like, hey, you need to take a look at what you're doing. And it was like, no, thank you. It wasn't safe. Like, reality wasn't safe. And so once I was told that I could no longer have alcohol, that's when I wanted it more than ever. Everything around me was starting to kind of crumble. But I just, again, I didn't know what to do. So just real quick, I did this 14-day rehab. Then I went into IOP. I got kicked out of IOP because of drinking. And again, I'm like, I'm supposed to be the one that lives inside the lines. I'm getting kicked out of an IOP. Like, reality, like, I was not recognizing what my life looked like. I did one-on-one therapy. I did marriage counseling. I drank through both of those things. COVID hit, and then I had family intervention, and I had to go to Black Bear. And I ended up getting kicked out of Black Bear as well, but not for drinking. It was because of COVID, and I got COVID, and they didn't know what to do with me, so they sent me home to do an online IOP. And online IOP worked for a little while, but of course it didn't work permanently. And I ended up just kind of like blowing up the holidays that year. I made it a couple of months and then started at Thanksgiving and absolutely ruined Christmas of 2020. And then I went to the hospital back to back. The second time there was like an ambulance and a fire truck and a whole thing. I woke up in the hospital and they told me that my blood alcohol was 0.4, which I didn't realize at the time was so bad. Like, I woke up in the hospital, didn't know where I was. They told me my blood alcohol was 0.4, and I still thought everyone was overreacting. And I was like pretty mad about it. This was around the time when I was just, like, lying straight to people's faces. So, like, Amanda, we think there's alcohol in this home. Is there alcohol in the home? Just look you dead in the eye and be like, there is no alcohol in this house. And that's how I ruined Christmas of 2020. Just kidding. But by February of 2021, like, I really did want to stop drinking, and that's how I got to Talbot for the first time. Talbot's here in Atlanta. And I had to go through Black Bear in order to go to Talbot. So every time that I go to Talbot, wait for it, there's plenty of times where I'm going to cycle through Talbot, but I had to go through Black Bear. And so I did that for the first time. I was at Talbot. I got served divorce papers 2 days in the rehab. And then I stayed sober for about 8 months, and I did some sober living, but then the day, honestly to this day don't remember if it was the day I moved out or the day after I relapsed when I moved into my own place. And then I went back to Talbot again for their relapse track. And so I stayed for just 6 weeks that time. I still, this entire time, have not told my work what's going on, because I don't want anyone to know. I don't want anyone to suspect that anything is wrong, even though I kept leaving for, like, multiple months at a time. I was like, they'll never know. So then the relapse track lasted for a while as well, but I only made it a couple of months. And then I was about to finalize my divorce by this point. We had gone through a lot. And I got a second DUI. Honestly, I'm still so embarrassed about the first DUI. Like, I couldn't shake it. And I ended up getting a second DUI. And then at that point, it was like, I don't know what to do. Rehab was okay, because rehab was always a safe space for me, where I would remember that I was a human being. So I would become a person again, and rather than, like, this outwardly facing person, but, like, on the inside, kind of, like, dead inside, shell of a human being. Like, in rehab, I actually would, like, come into my body and remember that I was okay. But then I would go out into the real world, and I would need to be fine so that everyone else was fine. And I couldn't figure out how to continue to be a real person on the outside. everything was still so surreal, so unimaginable. Like, I couldn't even square what had happened with what was happening, and it just always felt like this shouldn't be how things are. Things should be different. They shouldn't be this way. And I also, like, didn't know how to build a community in recovery. I was always self-conscious. Like, it just felt like they know what they're doing. Everyone else, like, they know how to call other alcoholics. I don't know how to call other alcoholics. Like, I used to pregame in order to make a phone call. And, like, they know everyone at the meeting. I don't know these people at the meeting. And, like, everybody just felt so far ahead. And I also wanted to do it all by myself. Like, I wanted to design my own recovery. And at every phase, I was like, oh, I'm just trying to do it by myself again. This time, I'm going to do it with other people's help. And then I didn't want anybody to know I needed help. And the thing I've been thinking about, like, in trying to prepare for this talk and in reflecting is, like, I always wanted to be better before I was better. And, like, if you're thinking about it as, like, okay, we're all climbing some stairs together, it was like, if you're on the second step, you can still see people at the landing, or you can see people on the second floor, but and they can see you on the second step, and you're like, well, if I can see it, shouldn't I be there? Like, shouldn't I already be on the second floor by now? But, like, you can't actually get to the third step without taking the second step. And you can't get to the fourth step without taking the third step. And, like, if I were to be on the second floor without having taken each of the steps individually, then it would be, like, me going back to just faking it on the outside without having, like, the authenticity to back it up, and, like, going back to that, like, shell of a human that, like, I would show up to rehab again and be like, I'm dead inside again. I did not know what to do. And so, like, there's just this part of me that's like, I read the other day that the 12 steps mark our road to recovery. And they're in order because they help build. I can't start apologizing to people if I'm repeating the same behaviors that I was doing before. And if I'm going to be going through difficult things in life, like, I have to have a little bit better sense of who I am. What am I feeling? Can I deal with those feelings? Like, until I've built a community that's supporting me in case it feels too hard or the feelings become too intense, I'm not ready to deal with some of that other stuff. And I also, it's taken me some time to kind of rely on a power outside of myself to do all of this. And I think I kept wanting that to be the case, but then it would just, like, my ego would step in, my pride would step in, and I didn't want to ask for help, I didn't want people to know I was struggling, and, like, there's something about needing time to get perspective, and so every single day that I've been sober, it, like, adds to that. At Talbot, I ended up going to Talbot 3 times, so that the last time I was at Talbot was my 8th intake. But they encouraged me to move to Atlanta and into sober living. They were like, why don't you get off this rat wheel that you won't get off of? And I did. So I started taking advice, and I ended up staying in sober living for over a year. I found a sponsor at 8111 that I could be honest with. I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but that feeling that I would get when I would tell my family that I had been thinking about drinking or that I wasn't doing well, like that look of sheer panic on their face of like, oh God, here we are. You know, the thing I love about my sponsor is that she doesn't have that desire to like control or fix. Like, I don't have to protect my sponsor. I can say whatever I want to my sponsor and she's fine. She's fine. And, she doesn't need protection from whatever's in my brain. And I was also thinking about, like, the meetings are another space. Like, the meetings don't need to be protected. I can show up to the meetings and, you know, just, like, get out whatever I need to, and the meetings don't need to be protected from me. And so I don't have to be okay. My sponsor's okay. She's not trying to fix me because she knows it's not her job. Like, she recognizes that there's a power outside of herself and there's a power outside of myself that is supposed to be doing something here. And that same power that's taken away, that's compulsion. Like, I used to, if I thought about a drink, I needed to go get a drink and there would be, they call it that strange mental blank spot. Like they were just, I don't know how I have it, but now the alcohol's in my hand. And whatever has taken away that compulsion is kind of my starting place for how I think about a power outside of myself. Like, I know that to be true in my own experience. And so let's tap into that and see what else is there. Let's go from there. And that's kind of helped me. Like, I have this religious upbringing that I want to be respectful of, but at the same time, like, I don't know how to use a power greater than myself on a day-to-day basis, and this program has kind of taught me about what that might look like for me. I heard recently another speaker say that they were struggling with the spiritual part of the program, and somebody said to them, there is no other part of the program. And I like that because the way that I've been thinking about it is like all of this is just sort of me figuring out how to do life and how to work this program of recovery. So like it really started in sober living when it was like I knew what my chores were that week. And I would have these feelings of, you know, like I shouldn't be in sober living. I shouldn't be in a place where I have a twin bed and a roommate and like chaos around. Like, this just shouldn't be my life. But like this time around, sober living was kind of where I leaned into like, this is exactly where you should be. And this is exactly where you belong. And, you know, sometimes my chores for that week would be, you know, clean the toilet. Like you're cleaning the toilet for everyone else. And there was something about like, all I have to do is exist. I go to meetings. And I take care of my chores, and I take pride in whatever the chores, like, I try to do it well. And, like, that was all I had to do, and I was, like, succeeding at that point. And so sober living is kind of where I reset my bar for life at, like, am I existing? Did I stay sober today? And when I do that, I feel successful. I feel like I added another day. I feel like I added another element to that, like, climbing the steps, you know? And there really isn't more for me to be doing. So this part of my brain that's like, you're not enough. You haven't done enough. Things should be better. Things should be more. Like, it's okay if I have those thoughts. It would be natural for me to have those thoughts. But I think what I'm kind of leaning into in sobriety is that all I'm trying to do here is, like, stay sober, ideally help other alcoholics because they help me stay sober, and then go from there and see what happens. And this leaning into a power outside of myself is changing things from feeling like a future of dread and I already know what's going to happen to this feeling of like, I don't know what's going to happen. And that feels a lot safer and a lot better to me right now. It's like leaving room for possibility. So when I drink, I usually drink at stuff that's non-existent. So it's like the perception of the thing is what's painful rather than the actual thing itself. And so, you know, I would drink at things like, oh, well, I'm never going to be successful in my career because I've already ruined it with all this crap that I, you know, introduced. And, like, that's a perception that I have. I have a perception that I'm not going to be okay. I'm not going to be okay. I'm not going to have what I want, or I'm going to lose something that I have. But the reality is, and one thing that my sponsor has been, like, working on me with is, like, are you actually okay? Like, are you okay in this moment? Like, in the present moment, are you okay? And the answer has been yes a lot more than I thought it would be. And I think the times that I've relapsed, I've been really sad and really caught up in like, the perception of stuff. And when things feel very oppressive and they feel depressing and they feel, like, insurmountable, then I started to feel like there's nothing I can do to get out of where I'm at right now. And then if there's nothing I can do, screw it. Like, I'm gonna introduce a little bit of chaos into this. But the times that I've introduced chaos have all gone awry. And when I've just been like, I'm just gonna drink, it's probably gonna be fine. Like, I have done that textbook thing where, like, every time I relapse, it's been worse. And so now I know exactly how I would relapse. Like, I know exactly what my first drink would feel like. I know that I would want a second one. I know after the second one, I'm less concerned with what I'm doing, and I'm more concerned with, like, the third drink. And then after the third drink, I want 20. And now if I relapsed, that would happen right away. Because it has. Because that's been my experience. And there are still certain things that, like, haven't happened yet. But at the same time, like, I don't know, people tried to sort of stop that train from barreling forward for me. A lot of people tried to help, and I just, like, wouldn't get off it until, like, I absolutely crashed and burned the entire train down. And so there's part of me that's like, could I have gotten off the train faster? Like, could I have done something differently? Could I have, like, done a better job in recovery earlier? But now I have those experiences to look back on and to remember. Like, I still think about drinking pretty often. Like, I went to a movie this weekend, and I was like, should I smuggle a water bottle in here full of vodka? But now I can sort of watch the thought cross my brain and be like, it makes sense that I have that thought. I'm an alcoholic. Like, it makes sense. So I'm not scared of my thoughts as much, because when I'm scared of them, then they tend to have a little bit more power. But now it's just kind of like, well, yeah, I don't know. It makes sense, you know. And if I need to, then I work the program. And what that has looked like for me is, like, when they say in the program that you can act your way into better thinking, but you can't think your way into better action, like, that has been my experience as well. So when I call my sponsor now, most of the time when I call her and I need to talk, I don't really know what's wrong. I'll just call and be like, I just don't feel good. And she'll ask me a series of questions usually, and it's usually like, have you prayed about it? Have you been to a meeting? Are you working with another alcoholic? Like, are you basically getting out of your own head? And there's a part of it, like, at times I'll resent it, but I'm, like, such a simple creature that truly, if I work this program, that is, like, if I can answer yes to those, then I'm usually on my way. I really just need to call somebody else, or, like, usually when I'm supposed to call somebody else is when I least want to see or speak to another human being. And so it's, like, been working with my sponsor where it's like, well, you just go. Like, you don't have to want to go, you just go. And that wasn't something that I think I really knew how to do, that I'm trying to practice now. And then it works, and I'm like, such a little, you know, robot monkey. I don't know. I just, it actually works, and you're like, all right, well, I guess I'm like everyone else. Just the other thing I wanted to say was just about practicing not knowing. And that has been very comforting. Like, one thing that my brain is trained to do is to say, if I do this, I know X is going to happen. And this program is kind of teaching me to say, like, you just take the action without an expectation of what that's going to mean. Because what kept me from doing a lot of things was, like, I had already pre-written the future, and the future was terrible. And so now, everything is, like, still, I still have to go through life, and everything is still a challenge, but if I can make it through the day and stay in my skin, and I'm, like, working on this relationship with my body and my brain and, like, integrating all of that, and if I can work that and I can trust that this power outside of myself is going to take care of things, then I don't want to crawl out of my skin anymore. Like, I can do it. I can just take the next action and go from there, and I don't have to know what that's going to mean or what that's going to look like in the future. And that includes doing this tonight. Like I said, I don't know who let me up here, but I'm, like, so grateful, because I don't know what's going to come from this either. I know I was a little anxious about it, and I know that when you're asked to do something, say yes, and that's just what I did. So I really appreciate being asked, because this is very helpful for me to get it out and to talk about it. And to see all of you, there's a lot of people who came tonight that I know and love, and that was a big deal for me. So I want to thank each of you that I know that is here, but I also want to thank each of you that I don't know that is here. I'd love to talk to you after if you want to. Thank you again.
thank you once again, Amanda, for your story. And I've asked Amber to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, I'm Amber. I'm in recovery.
Hey.
Hey, they go through the chips, offer them out, kind of just explain them a little. The first one we have is the white chip. I'm tired of a high cost of low living. It's the only one you get for free. Anybody want to pick up a white chip tonight? All right. After that, you earn 30 days, one day at a time, with a camel on it. Anybody have 30 days? Okay, and then after that, we have 60 days in a row. And a row is the big part of it, big deal. Then we get to our red chip for 90 days. Your blood is clear of alcohol or any other substance. The yellow chip, you're in the right place for 6 months. I've heard this one is the hardest to get. The grass has grown back between you and the liquor store. The green chip for 9 months. Anybody have 9 months? All right, I know we have a special chip tonight, but does anybody that we are not aware of have a year? You made it your whole year.
Hey, everybody, I'm Ellen. I'm an alcoholic.
Amanda? Wait, I think, thank you so much. This is my home group, and I'm nervous. Because I don't think I've ever seen this many people in here. So thank you for being willing to get up there and share your experience, strength, and hope. I appreciate that.
Tonight is this little angel's 1 year. Right. I am just so grateful that she saw something in me and asked me to be her sponsor. She's only my second sponsee, so I was like, whew, okay, yes, I'll do it. Because as you said, if you're asked to do something, you say yes, right? Then I said, just call me or text me every day, you know, let me know how you're doing. And so when she started texting, she's like, hey, so I had this feeling today, and I know that if I go to page 88 through 86 through 88, I'll be able to read, and I know what I, and I was like, maybe she knows a little bit more than I do. However, doesn't matter how much you know or how long you've been here, it's always, always special to help someone. And she has just jumped in with both feet, and not one thing, suggestions that I give her, she'll do them. She doesn't ask questions. She works the steps to the best of her ability and is just phenomenal. For a year, most people, me included, did not ever want to do service work. This girl here, if you need service work, just ask Alex because she'll do it. This is our special chip that I got for you. It's got butterflies and pink flowers on it.
My name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Ellen is not my first sponsor, but she is the first sponsor I listen to. It turns out it's not rigorous honesty to only call your sponsor every now and then and tell them how great you're doing. And it's not complete willingness to only do back dating. And I had a problem with confusing familiarity with participation. So I could quote the book, and I knew the things. Whether or not I actually did the things was a different story. And once I became willing to admit that maybe somebody knows a tiny bit more than I do, and I became willing to listen to them and do the things, that's when things got better. And things are a lot better now.
And I think that's it. Surrender was the last thing I wanted to do. There ain't no denying the pain you put me through. I thought I knew you so well. Guess I have to blame myself for letting you burn me till I was head down, hell bound, digging that hole and my soul got tired, wound up, burned out. Devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, I came in here running from the fire. Sweet talking, heartbreaker, you had me believe that you love me, but you gave me one match in gasoline. It all happened so fast, nothing was left but ashes. I should have seen it coming, but I was head down, hell bound, digging that hole in my soul, got tired, wound up, burned out. The devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. There are lessons I'm still learning, hearts I've broken, I'm still hurting. Bridges that will keep on burning, and it's all because of you and the things you made me do. I was head down, hell bound, digging that hole and my soul got tired, wound up, burned out. The devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. Oh, I didn't come here looking for the light. No, I came in here running from the fire.